is Cascadia Public Radio.
Information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
The law. The country.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Episode 108 of Media Monarchy, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully investigate the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, observe, dissect, and offend the rise of Barack Hussein Obama and the fall of Sam Adams, the scandalized mayor of Portland, Oregon. We're here. We've made it relatively unscathed, my friends, through all the presidential bread and circus. We're here at episode 108, January 23rd, 2009. Change has come to America, and we'll just see about that. January 23rd, 2009, episode 108 of MediaMonarchy.com.
We don't need no good reason for the function of our meeting here tonight. Call the law, call it treason. We're beyond realms of believing wrong or right. So I don't know what you voted for. So I don't know, but I know one thing that's for sure. I got this book, I've been reading. Got me thinking 'tis the season of a song. Hey. Cause we're the government. Oh, oh, oh. We're the law. Cause we're the government. Yes, we are. Citizens, we declare declaratives and deny the officials. Based in the landmark of the G-spot, we have overtaken ourselves and overthrown our forefathers. Let there be light within the light, and an answer to the name of darkness. We have forever risen from the deadly, the antivirus, and the all-stars granted power by forces unbeknownst to us. Made in the likeness of kindness, we offer anger to the angry and fear to the fearful. We dance at our own funeral to protect the mourners. This is no time to cry. This is no time at all. Here is the moment of the overlooked and the unforeseeable. We are the elected officials of the people, poets and artists. We are the declarative statement of the inarticulate, the irreparably damaged goods of the bad, meaning good. We are the government. We are the government. We are the government. Let's be the government. Yes, we are. We're the government. We're the law. We're the government. Yes, we are.
Should we be praying to inside of me and you?
Inside of me and you.
Now does that ring is true? Or should I look up and away? got right here today.
Government. We are the government. That's brand new music. You heard it here first from Saul Williams. SaulWilliams.com. He uploaded that track, The Government, on, of course, Inauguration Day on January 20th, 2009. I've been a longtime fan of Saul Williams. Seen him live. Have all his records. But sometime early last year, the amount of Obama Kool-Aid he started to drink really left a bad taste in my mouth, and I kind of turned off from him. However, I got to give credit where credit is due. That track is killer, and Saul Williams is an amazing artist. It was just all his bloviating last spring about Obama. Of course, after all, the Democrats fell into line and got behind the Obama-siah. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, welcome to episode 108 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's January 23rd, 2009. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. The single obsessed person behind MediaMonarchy.com. Blasting out to you originally, live, as always, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, thanks to the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. Now, for the last several weeks, Revere Radio has been carrying Media Monarchy for a long time, back since, I believe, episode 20. And I love them and thank them. They were replaying the episode for the last couple years. As of the last couple of weeks, we're live on revereradionetwork.com, revereradio.net, and of course, it's 1 p.m. on the East Coast. KBFR 93.9 in Boulder, Colorado, blasts out MediaMonarchy.com, and I thank them as well. And of course, I always implore you to hit me up on Facebook or MySpace or YouTube or Yahoo. I am with Media Monarchy as your keyword. Signed in right now. Sometimes my internet connections are sketchy when I'm doing the show live here. You never know what kind of wireless signal you're going to be able to grab or not. But right now I'm signed in, so maybe hit me up with a comment. It may be distracting. We'll see. We're here. I never thought all this shit would end. But of course it doesn't end. This was just the end of the beginning. And we have much to go over and dissect with the coronation of Obama. But we got to set the table. And we're going to have to look back a little bit. So hopefully, but probably not the last time, we're going to look back at the criminal Bush regime. another one that I love to hate to love, much like Saul Williams and some of the other folks out there. But like Keith Olbermann, he does it right sometimes, and you got to give it to him. Brace yourself. 8 years in 8 minutes.
George Walker Bush, 43rd president of the United States, first ever with a criminal record. Our third story tonight, his presidency, 8 years in 8 minutes. Early in 2001, the U.S. fingered al-Qaeda for the bombing of the USS Cole. Bush counterterrorism advisor Richard Clark had a plan to take down al-Qaeda. Instead, by February, the NSC had already discussed invading Iraq and had a plan for post-Saddam Iraq. By March 5th, Bush had a map ready for Iraqi oil exploration and a list of companies. Al-Qaeda? Rice told Clark not to give Bush a lot of long memos, not a big reader. August 6th, 2001, a CIA analyst briefs Bush on vacation. Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. Bush takes no action, tells briefer, quote, all right, you covered your ass now. Next month, Clark requests using new Predator drones to kill Bin Laden. The Pentagon and CIA say no. September 11th, Bush remains seated for several minutes to avoid scaring schoolchildren by getting up and leaving. He then flies around the country and promises, quote, a full-scale investigation to find those folks who did it. Rumsfeld says Afghanistan does not have enough targets. We've got to do Iraq. When the CIA traps Bin Laden at Tora Bora, it asks for 800 Rangers to cut off his escape. Bush outsources the job to Pakistanis sympathetic to the Taliban. Bin Laden gets away. In February, General Tommy Franks tells a visiting senator Bush is moving equipment out of Afghanistan so he can invade Iraq. One of the men who prepped Rice for her testimony that Bush did not ignore pre-9/11 warnings later explains, quote, we cherry-picked things to make it look like the president had been actually concerned about al-Qaeda. They didn't give a bleep about al-Qaeda. July, and Britain's intel chief says Bush is fixing intelligence and facts around the policy to take out Saddam. January 03, Bush and Blair agreed to invade in March. Mr. Bush still telling us he has not decided, telling Blair they should paint an airplane in UN colors, fly it over Iraq, and provoke a response, a pretext for invasion. The man who said it would take several hundred thousand troops, fired. The man who said it would cost more than $100 billion, fired. The man who revealed Bush's yellow cake lie, smeared. His wife's covert status, exposed. The White House liars who did it and covered it up, not fired. One convicted. Bush commutes his sentence. Then in Iraq, stuff happens. Iraq's army disbanded. The government debathified. 200,000 weapons, billions of dollars just lost. Foreign mercenaries immunized from justice. Political hacks run the green zone. Religious cleansing forcing one out of six Iraqis from their homes. Abu Ghraib, the insurgency, al-Qaeda in Iraq. Other stuff does not happen. WMD, post-war planning, body armor, vehicular armor. The payoff? Oil and billions for Halliburton, Blackwater, and other companies. While Mr. Bush denies VA health care to 450,000 veterans, tries to raise their health care fees, blocks the new GI Bill, and increases his own power with the USA Patriot Act, with the Military Commissions Act, public orders exempting himself from 1,000 laws, and secretly from the Presidential Records Act, the Geneva Conventions, FISA, sparking a mass rebellion at the Justice Department, secret star chambers for terrorism suspects, overturned by Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, denying habeas corpus, overturned by Boumediene v. Bush, 200 renditionings, sleep deprivation, abuse. Rumsfeld warned in 2002 that he was tortured, that it would jeopardize convictions. Out of 550 at Gitmo, hundreds ultimately go free with no charges. Dozens are tortured, 8 fatally, 3 are convicted. On U.S. soil, 1,200 immigrants rounded up without due process, without bail, without court dates, without a single charge of terrorism. It wasn't just Mr. Bush no longer subject to the rule of law. He slashed regulations on everyone from banks to mining companies, appointed 98 lobbyists to oversee their own industries, weakening emission standards for mercury and 650 different toxic chemicals. Regulators shared drugs and their beds with industry reps. The Crandall Canyon mine owner told inspectors to back up because his buddy, Republican Mitch McConnell, was sleeping with their boss. McConnell's wife is Bush Labor Secretary Elaine Chao. Her agency overruled engineer concerns about Crandall Canyon and was found negligent after 9 miners died in the collapse there. Mr. Bush's handoff is Enron blacks out California, doubling electric bills. After months of rejecting price caps, Mr. Bush bows to pressure. The blackouts end. Mr. Bush further deregulates commodity futures, midwifing the birth of unregulated oil markets, which, just like Enron, jack up prices to an all-time high until Congress and both presidential candidates call for regulations and the prices fall. deregulating financial services and lax enforcement of remaining rules created a housing bubble, creating the mortgage crisis, creating then a credit crisis, devastating industries that rely on credit from student loans to car dealers. Those that had survived the Great Depression could not survive Bush. Those that did got $700 billion. No strings, no transparency, no idea whether it worked. Unlike the auto bailout, which cut workers' salaries, a GOP memo called it a chance to punish unions. But Bush failed even when his party and his patrons did not stand to profit. Investigators blame management cost-cutting communication for missed warnings about Columbia. Bush administration convicts include sex offenders at Homeland Security, convicted liars, every kind of thief in the calendar. And if you count things that were not prosecuted, the vice president of the United States actually shot a man in the face. The man apologized. Mr. Bush faked the truth with paid propaganda in Iraq on his education policy, tried to silence the truth about global warming, rocket fuel in our water, industry influence on energy policy, politicized the truth of science at NASA, the EPA, the National Cancer Institute, Fish and Wildlife, and the FDA. His lies, exposed by whistleblowers from the cabinet down. Complete BS, the Treasury Secretary said, of Mr. Bush on his tax cuts. Rice's mushroom cloud, Powell's mobile labs, Iraq and 9/11, Jack Abramoff, Jessica Lynch, Pat Tillman again. The air at ground zero, most refiners still suffering respiratory problems. Global warming, carbon emissions, a clear skies initiative lowering air quality standards, the healthy forest initiative increasing logging, faith-based initiatives, the cost of Medicare reform, fired U.S. attorneys, politically synchronized terror alerts, the surge causing insurgents to switch sides, that abortion causes breast cancer, that his first recession began under Clinton, that he did not wiretap without warrants, that we do not torture. That American citizen John Walker Lynn's rights were not violated, that he refused the right to counsel. Heck of a job, Brownie. Some survivors still in trailers, New Orleans still at just two-thirds its usual population. The lie that no one could have predicted the economic crisis except the economists who did. No one could have predicted 9/11 except one ass-covering CIA analyst or 30. No one could have predicted the levee breach except literally Mr. Bill, in a PSA that aired on TV a year before Katrina. Bush actually admitted that he lied about not firing Rumsfeld because he did not want to tell the truth. Look it up. All of it and more, leaving us with $10 trillion in debt to pay for 31% more in discretionary spending, the Iraq War, a $1.3 trillion tax cut, median income down $2,000, three-quarters of all income gains under Bush going to the richest 1%, unemployment up from 4.2 to 7.2%, the Dow down from 10,587 to 8,277, 6 million now more in poverty, 7 million more now without health care, buying toxic goods from China, deadly cribs, outsourcing security to Dubai, still unsecure at our ports and at our nuclear plants, more dependent on foreign oil, out of the International Criminal Court, off the anti-ballistic missile treaty, military readiness and standards down, with two unfinished wars, a nuclear North Korea, disengaged in the Palestinian problem, destabilizing Eastern European diplomacy with anti-missile plans, and unable to keep Russia out of Georgia. 2,000 miles of Appalachian streams destroyed by rubble from mountaintop mining. At his last G8 summit, he actually bid farewell to other world leaders, saying, quote, goodbye from the world's greatest polluter. Consistently undermining historic American reverence for institutions that empower us. Education, now academic elites. And the law, activist judges capping jury awards. And bin Laden, living today unmolested in a Pakistani safe haven, created by a truce, endorsed, and defended by George W. Bush. And among all the gifts he gave to bin Laden, the most awful, the most damaging, not just to America, but to the American ideal, was to further bin Laden's goal by making us act out of fear rather than fortitude, leaving us with precious little to cling to tonight, save the one thing that might yet suffice. Hope.
It's going to take a lot of hope to undo that. Keith Olbermann, 8 years and 8 minutes, and that, of course, just scratches the surface. And there is much to debate and discuss within there, and whether or not the reality is that the new administration is going to change much, if any, of that. Now, as I was thinking about how long has this been going on, I hit the Obama label on MediaMonarchy.com. You know the labels at the bottom of all the posts that if you hit that, it'll show you all the posts that have that subject. So I hit Obama and went through page after page after page after page to get to the first mention that I found, at least initially, on MediaMonarchy.com of Barack Obama. Goes back 21 months ago. Back to April 25th, 2007, Giuliani warns of new 9/11 if Dems win. And I posted this up under the heading of He Would Know. From Politico, again, April 25th, 2007, Giuliani said if a Democrats elect a president in 2008, America will be at risk for another terrorist attack on the scale of 9/11. But if a Republican is elected, he said, especially if it's him, terrorist attacks can be anticipated and stopped. If any Republican is elected president, I think obviously I'd be the best at this, we will remain on offense and will anticipate what the terrorists will do and try to stop them before they do it, Giuliani said. Now, the fireback from the Boston Globe. Democrats fire back at Giuliani on 9/11 warning. Democratic White House contenders Barack Obama and Hillary Rodham Clinton criticized Republican Rudolph Giuliani on Wednesday for suggesting a Democratic president would put the United States at risk of another September 11th type terrorist attack. Rudy Giuliani has taken the politics of fear to a new low, and I believe Americans are ready to reject those kind of politics, Obama, an Illinois senator, said in a statement. The threat we face is real and deserves better than to be a punchline of another political attack, Obama said. First mention I could find of Barack Hussein Obama on MediaMonarchy.com, April 25th, 2007, Democrats fire back at Giuliani on 9/11 warning. So, flash forward 21 months through ridiculous bread and circus dog and pony show where any candidates who had anything real and progressive and substantive to talk about, like Nader or McKinney or Paul or Kucinich or Gravel, this is what we've got. This is what you want. This is what you get. Many postings, of course, that spanned the day before, day of, and day after the Obamasiah coronation. They're all massive postings, and they're all up for you on MediaMonarchy.com. All the links are there, all the videos, all the PDFs, all the photos, all the ridiculous things swirling around this coronation. First, from Monday, January 19th, Obamasiah coronation, the police state celebrates change. From the Washington Post, inauguration is climax to 2 years of increasing security around Obama as jubilant Democrats nominated Senator Barack Obama for president in a Denver convention hall in late August. The U.S. Secret Service in Washington placed its largest ever order for bulletproof glass. We covered that story extensively. The service requested about 5 tons of quote-unquote transparent armor, laminated with 4 layers of virtually unbreakable plastic to resist chemicals, flames, and multiple gunshots. When Obama is sworn in as the nation's 44th president, the ballistic shield will provide a final layer of safety in a massive exercise in presidential security, the culmination of 2 years of a steady ratcheting up of the protection around Obama to a level unseen for any of his predecessors. You can hit the link to police1.com and read more about ballistic shields and tactical police products. But this is the first of literally dozens of stories covering the amazing police state surrounding this coronation. Next, from the AFP, the French agency press, unprecedented security as Obama set for White House. Unprecedented security blanket. And what does a security blanket do? It makes you feel safe. It doesn't actually protect you, because that's impossible. An unprecedented security blanket has been draped over the U.S. Capitol for Obama's inauguration, and the threat level to the country's first black president is expected to remain high, well beyond his swearing in. More than 12,500 active troops and military reservists, thousands of Metropolitan Police, as well as personnel from 57 departments around the nation, descended on Washington to protect against any potential terrorist attack during Tuesday's historic ceremony. More from Danger Room. Downtown D.C. becomes the Green Zone. In addition to a record number of house guests, with a link to the LA Times, and an explosion of kitsch, with a link to the UPI, Washington, D.C. is witnessing an unprecedented surge in security for the presidential inauguration. A force of 20,000 police officers, National Guard troops, and plainclothes agents, with a link to CBSNews.com, will be on the streets, and we're on the streets, and we're watching over you, and watching over the coronation festivities. F-16 fighters and Patriot missile batteries were on alert to defend the Capitol's airspace. Raw replay and NBC News cover Chertoff and the officials at the coronation searching for quote-unquote bigoted threats.
It is an extraordinary undertaking that starts with a lot of security, so let's start there. 58 law enforcement and other agencies, as well as 10,000 National Guard troops on hand to make sure that everything goes off without a hitch, and that's one of the reasons that this inaugural is expected to be the most expensive ever. The celebrations began on Saturday with a whistle-stop tour from Philadelphia to Washington, the Obamas following kind of an abridged version of Abraham Lincoln's journey by train to his own inauguration back in 1861. And then on Sunday, a sign of the kind of crowds that are being anticipated for the next couple of days, several hundred thousand people turned out for a concert at the Lincoln Memorial. How about that for a setting featuring Bruce Springsteen, Garth Brooks, Beyonce, U2, and much more.
Pretty incredible. Of course, today is Martin Luther King Day, a day that's become a national day of service in honor of Dr. King's legacy. The Obamas are hoping to usher in a new era of service, and to do their part, they'll be joined by the Biden family today at a community renovation project here in Washington. This, as the rest of Washington prepares for tomorrow's official transfer of power, the inaugural ceremony, the parade down Pennsylvania Avenue. And we're going to preview it all for you today and put the moment in historic context as well.
But let's begin on this Monday morning with the security for the most carefully guarded inaugural ever. Thousands of police and National Guardsmen are already out in force. NBC's Justice correspondent Pete Williams is at the National Mall with more on this. Hi, Pete. Good morning.
Matt, good morning to you. Those involved in the planning say there is no doubt about it. This will be the most heavily secured public event in U.S. history. It's partly the nature of the ceremony and partly the size of the expected crowd. Federal agents say they know of no credible threat against tomorrow's inaugural.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear.
And even though every president brings unique security challenges,
so help me God,
those in charge of this inaugural say they're well aware of what's involved in protecting the first African American to take the oath.
That will excite bad acts on the part of a certain small percentage of the population who are bigoted. And so we want to be mindful that none of those people find their way into the area of proximity to the new incoming president.
That's why federal agents say they've combed through past threats against Obama and re-interviewed informants. In the subways and throughout the inaugural crowd, 155 intelligence teams will watch for signs of trouble.
All right, bring us in, Mark.
On the water, the U.S. Coast Guard is pushing its fast patrol boats even further out than it did past inaugurals. It's partly a response to November's terror attack in Mumbai. The men responsible for it arrived by boat. On Tuesday, those boats will shut down Washington's river traffic.
It'll be a very robust presence out here for the law enforcement assets that are out on the water.
Overhead, helicopters and military jets will enforce a strict no-fly zone. A force of 25,000 police, federal agents, and National Guardsmen, unprecedented in size, will provide protection and help control the crowd, which this year will spread onto the long parkland of the National Mall. Security there got an early test at Sunday's concert at the Lincoln Memorial, with counter snipers keeping a lookout. On Tuesday, 150 blocks of downtown Washington will be closed to traffic, and seven bridges from Northern Virginia will be open for the thousands of expected buses, but no private cars allowed. That has angered some.
I am, you know, honored that we will have a new president, and but I think that they're taking it a little bit too far.
But the director of the Secret Service says cars would jam the bridges, making them useless if needed for evacuation.
We want to make sure that if in the event there was an
any type of an incident, those who are here in town would be able to leave the district in an orderly fashion.
There's no dependable estimate yet of how many people are coming, but it's expected to easily break the record, 1.2 million people, for Lyndon Johnson's inaugural 44 years ago. Meredith?
Pete Williams, thank you.
Which makes me wonder, why did so many people show up for LBJ? Anyway, that's NBC talking to Chertoff, talking about bigoted threats, talking about the police state at the inauguration. More from Bloomberg. Washington mobilizes 42,500 strong security force for inaugural when senior FBI official Joseph Parrishini takes his 5 a.m. jog down Washington's National Mall. He imagines everything that could go wrong at Obama's inaugural. He said he thinks about the possibility of a sleet storm, bombing, chemical attack, or perhaps harnessed to guard against the lone gunman bent on turning a celebration into a national tragedy. But if we move to now another one from Raw Replay, this time from CNN. We heard them just mention the counter snipers, so let's learn more about those men in black.
Wow, they make it look so cool, don't they? But in real life, those men in black are in charge of protecting our next president. They've got a far more nerve-wracking job because there is so much at stake. Our Gene Meserve is live at Freedom Plaza here in D.C. this morning to tell us what it's like to be a part of the Secret Service elite. Hey, Gene.
Hey, John, if you are here on the parade route tomorrow and you look up the top of any of these buildings, you're likely to see them, men in black with rifles at the ready to protect the president.
First man, I got target one.
Target
one.
Hey. They shoot with great accuracy at great distances.
Hit right eye.
And call it a blend of art and science. They are the counter snipers of the U.S. Secret Service.
They're very good, and I would put them among the best in the world at what they do.
The counter snipers consider themselves the most elite unit in the uniformed Secret Service. 9 weeks of intense training turned them into Olympic quality shooters. They have to requalify monthly. Standards are so high, half of the agents accepted for training wash out.
Hit! Left long!
Each counter sniper uses a rifle customized for his height and arm length. They work in two-man teams. Though both are expert marksmen, only one shoots at a time. The other gauges the wind, which can change a bullet's trajectory.
Hit! Hit! High in the forehead!
There are different methods. Smoke from chimneys, undulations, and the mirage from heat. Foliage on the trees, flagpoles.
When a president is going to move along a public route, the counter snipers scout it out to assess the threat and find good vantage points for themselves. On inauguration day, some will position themselves on rooftops with a view of the parade route, the crowd, and other buildings where snipers could be hiding. The cold will be biting, but the counter snipers can wear lightweight gloves, and they have tricks for keeping mental focus no matter what the weather.
When it's hot in the summer, we think about the cold days in January, and then in January we're thinking about what's happening in August.
And we can bet that tomorrow they're going to be thinking about August. And by the way, they make no effort to hide themselves. They want the bad guys to know they're there, ready to shoot. John?
You know, I've been trying to employ some of the psychological tricks this morning, pretending I'm actually on a beach in Florida this morning, Gene, but it's just not working. I don't know why. It's interesting, though, as you say, that they want... Yeah, it's interesting, though, as you say, that they want people to know that they're there. And we were at the Lincoln Memorial yesterday for the We Are One concert, and they were prominently displaying themselves on the top of the Lincoln Memorial. So they're really sending a message to people that we are here. If you've got any nefarious intent, you better think twice about it because we're watching you.
Exactly. The idea is deterrence. If people see them, they'll be less likely to do something they shouldn't do.
All right, Gene Meserve for us in Freedom Plaza this morning. Gene, thanks so much. It's great to see you.
That's a strange little clip from CNN. It could be an episode of Homeland Security USA, the new reality show. Fox News, Washington assembles largest inauguration security force ever. 2 million people, 4 million, bring them on. If, as expected, a record crowd turns out for Obama's inauguration, Washington will be ready with the largest number of security people ever assembled in the nation's capital. U.S. Secret Service overseeing a force, like we said, more than 40,000 people, 7,500 active duty soldiers, 10,000 National Guard, 25 law enforcement officers. But to put it into perspective, thanks Fox News, that surpasses the 31,000 troops serving in Afghanistan. Just think about that. And think about Obama and ending the war in Iraq so we can focus more on Afghanistan or Pakistan or Russia. Finally, from the Washington Times, as we go through this posting, Obamasiah coronation, the police state celebrates change, all the mainstream media accounts of the massive police state tactics. Hopefully I have linked in here somewhere, there's a Time magazine article that basically says, is a police state really necessary? But lastly, on this posting from the Washington Times, Capitol to be virtually locked down for inauguration. The estimated crowd of more than a million for the inauguration in the district also bring thousands of law enforcement and military from across the country in an unprecedented security effort. It's clear that this is a historic event, and we understand the kinds of crowds that have come out to see President-elect Obama on the campaign trail, said Agent Malcolm Wiley, a U.S. Secret Service spokesman, and we believe this crowd may be larger than we've seen during past inaugurations. And we move to the next post, which focuses on those crowds. And again, I've discussed, but I also say that it's hard to do all of this justice, and I don't do it justice, and I don't do as well as I want to try and get the ideas and points across. But we've talked about Obama and his mass movement, and folks like Webster Griffin Tarpley have written books and articles and lectures and more and more and more, talking about how this mirrors other fascist movements in countries throughout history. So let's see if we can explain it a little bit. A new article from Kurt Nimmo is the first I got posted up under this next one. This again from Monday, the day before the inauguration. Obamasiah coronation, the flock is led to the slaughter. Obama's mass movement gets a new mission. People don't remember what fascism was, I'm afraid. A lot of people think, especially here in the U.S. where people are ignorant, people believe that fascism is a purely top-down phenomenon. Author Webster Griffin Tarpley told the Dutch journalist Don De Witt during an interview on May 11, 2008. We played some of that for you. The link is to deepjournal.com for that full interview. Fascism is the march on Rome. Fascism is the stormtroopers fighting in the streets. It's a gutter and street level movement. It's a grassroots movement that has anti-authoritarian cover, anti-parliamentary, anti-Congress cover. It has left cover. Left-wing cover. Mussolini, of course, was a revolutionary socialist, and a lot of people in his movement were left-wingers, extreme trade union activists, syndicalists, and stuff like this. In order for the banksters and the ruling elite behind Obama to realize their political agenda and wipe out all effective opposition in the process, the Obama mass movement, initially described as merely a grassroots political movement organized to get Obama elected, will now become Obama 2.0. or officially Organizing for America, a, quote, new group that aims to continue the grassroots advocacy that the former Illinois senator began in his presidential campaign.
When I'm sworn in as president of the United States, it will be because of you. You built the largest grassroots movement in history and shaped the future of this country. And the movement you built is too important to stop growing now. Today, I'm pleased to announce the creation of Organizing for America, the organization that will build on the movement you started during the campaign. As president, I will need the help of all Americans to meet the challenges that lie ahead. That's why I'm asking people like you, who fought for change during the campaign, to continue fighting for change in your communities. Since the election, hundreds of thousands of you shared your ideas about how this movement should move forward, and we've listened carefully. Volunteers, grassroots leaders, and ordinary citizens will continue to drive our organization, helping us bring about the changes we proposed during the campaign. A solution to our economic crisis, an end to the war in Iraq, affordable health